Australian rockers Jet, that song from 2003. We're talking with John Barber, a producer, writer of a fascinating documentary called The Garrison Tapes, the most personal, up close examination of Jim Garrison, the only law enforcement official to lead a formal investigation into the JFK assassination. We've heard a bit about John Barber's very compelling personal narrative. In a moment, I want to return to some of the essence of his film that you may not have heard before, including a showdown he had with NBC that really says quite a bit about how media operate in this country. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. John Barber, I want to bring the focus of the conversation back to Jim Garrison for a bit. In 1980, you had a chance to interview him. He had prosecuted a guy named Clay Shaw and lost. And it turns out now, we now know it's confirmed that Clay Shaw was, in fact, a CIA operative after all. You got Jim Garrison to talk to you. First time he talked to anybody in 10 years since the Shaw trial. But NBC really did a number on you and him. Tell me that story.
Okay, well, what happened when I created Real People and it became, and I predicted that I would change the face of American television in an interview by creating what I call the entertainment reality. I did not own the show. The show was owned by somebody else, but that somebody else was like Jerry Jones, who owns the Dallas Cowboys. He owns the stadium and the team, but he didn't know how to play the game. I was the quarterback and I was the principal writer. And I wrote nearly every one of those hours for the 3 years. So it became this monster hit. Well, when somebody owns something in television, as you know, the networks run to them and give them another show. Well, they gave this fellow a show, and I'm not going to name him, even though I will name him some other time, but I don't want to embarrass you or anything like that. So I will not name him, but you know who I'm talking about. Anyway, they offer him a show called Speak Up America. And he comes to me, it's sort of a ripoff of Network. Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. And it's sort of a man in the street interview show about major news events. Okay. So he keeps coming to me asking me if I would help him with the show. And I tell him I can't. I'm working 14 hours a day with Revo. I can't do it. So I refuse to do it. And I don't see him for weeks and weeks because I'm doing this. Then one day by accident, in the middle of the Los Angeles Times, read an article about the House Select Committee having concluded that four shots had been fired because Gary Mack in Dallas found a Dictamat with a Dictabelt. It was the open recording by a motorcycle officer recording the gunshots, and there were at least four, so they had no other choice but say there was probably a conspiracy. Okay, so I read it on page 13, and I'm stunned. So now, for the 10 years between 1970, when I tried to book him on AM and lost the show and he was canceled and that, I only talked to him three times on the phone about Watergate, about Vietnam. Some of the names at Watergate were also involved with Dallas. So I never met him. I just talked to him on the phone. When I saw this, I picked up the phone and called him immediately. And I said, Mr. Garrison, do you feel vindicated? And George just as quickly said, John, I feel like a blind man who's gotten a small trophy in a dark room, only I know I got it. I said, well, wait a minute. Walter Cronkite and Hunfinley and Brinkley and Peter Jennings, all aren't these guys calling you? He said, you're the only person to call me. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, you're not surprised, are you? And I said, yes, I'm stunned. I said, well, I want to tell you a story. He says, I've told it to nobody in 10 years. I said, you've seen my show? He said, yes, my family loves it. I said, well, there's another show called Speak Up, and I'm going to come down, and I'm going to tell your story. So I put him on camera for 3.5 hours. Now, he was the most interesting, stimulating, frightening, thrilling interview or moment I ever had in my life to this day. Now, at one point during the interview, I said to Mr. Garrison, you were an FBI agent, you're in the Air Force, you were at Dachau, had yourself photographed when they freed all those prisoners at Dachau, and you have a picture on your wall that said, lest we forget, being so conservative, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government? And he smiled, and he said, John, I guess as a kid I saw one too many Frank Capra movies. Well, George, that was me. I mean, I thought America was, you know, Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart And I guess so did Mr. Garrison. He said, John, I guess I'm living in a country that I wasn't born into. I said, well, I'm going to tell your story. Anyway, during the interview, I asked him, how many shooters do you think there were? He said, well, it was triangulation. He said, they work in teams of two, somebody with the rifle and somebody to retrieve the shell. But since this is such an important killing, they probably have a radio person. So a team, three teams, three people each. Then I say to him, how many people do you think actually knew he was going to be shot there? So he said, well, John, it's always on a need-to-know basis in the military. And then he calculated out. He said, I would say maximum 32. So anyway, I bring the tapes back. Now, the guy who's going to be doing the story on the air is a fellow named Marjo Gortner, who had been a prodigy child minister, and he was going to be sort of like the Peter Finch character in the show. There's so much material, it's two parts. So the first part opens up with Jim Garrison, prime time, 8 o'clock live at night, looking at Americans saying full voice and full face, Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with the assassinations. Matter of fact, he didn't fire a shot. The paraffin test proved it. Well, the audience is leaning forward. I mean, they're stunned. The ratings are phenomenal. Now I'm going to do part two the following week, okay? And then there is Marjo. I edit him in. He says, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters do you think there were? And he responds the way I just told you, three teams, three of each. It's all edited in bed. Okay, I'm the following week, I'm having a new home built for my son and my wife, spending a lot of money doing that. And so we're renting another place, and at 8 o'clock, we're lying in bed and we're looking at the show, and up comes the show, and there's Marjo Gortner comes on the screen, and he says, when we get to this point in the story, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters were there? And they cut to Jim Garrison, and he says 32.
Oh, man.
Then the phone rings, and it's the owner of the show. He says, John, what do you think? And I start screaming at him, what did you do, George? What did you do? For God's sake, what did you do? He said, Garrison's a nut. I said, no, he's not a nut. He's telling you the truth. You're the nut. He says, the guy is a nut. He deserves to be locked up. So I slammed down the phone, and I'm crying. It's only the second time in my life I ever cried, and I called Jim Garrison in New Orleans. And I'm bawling, and I said, Mr. Garrison, I don't know what happened. That's not the way it was supposed to be told. He said, John, calm down. Please calm down. Listen, that happens to me all the time. And I said, well, listen, you know what libel is. You're an attorney. You're a judge. It's deliberate slander. This is deliberate slander. He took the stuff in at midnight and re-edited it, and he called me up, which I recorded, and he says, you're a nut and deserve to be locked up. You sue him, and you'll own NBC, and you'll put that guy out of business, and I'll be your star witness. He says, John, if I spent my time in court going after people who libeled me, I would never get home to my family. My family loves your show. Just send us some Real People T-shirts, and we'll still be friends, and we'll still talk. I cried the whole night away. I went in the morning. I was furious, and I grabbed the young lady that I had hired to be the producer on the show. Her name was Donna Cantor. She was the daughter of one of my best friends, Hal Cantor, the best gag writer in Hollywood, who wrote most of the stuff for the Academy Awards for 20 years. And as a favor, I hired her to be the producer on this. Well, the owner had called her, brought her in at midnight. And I'm yelling at her, how could you do this? How could you do this? And she said, he ordered me not to call you. He made me do it. He made me do it. So needless to say, my days of Real People were over. They were absolutely and totally gone. And to this day, I have no idea why he did it, but there's a whole lot more to that story that I won't get into. So nobody would talk to me. I had just created the most popular show in America, and the only person who would talk to me was Sinatra. And the reason Sinatra was talking to me, it was now time to do what we had talked about. Remember you played a little while ago that little song, High Hopes?
Right.
In 1977 or 79, Bing Crosby died on a golf course in Spain. And when I became Sinatra's writer, and he paid me a lot, and if I didn't cash the checks, he would never hire me again, because I was trying to save all the checks and put them on the wall. So I had to cash them all. All I have on my wall now is a letter on my wall saying how we're going to do this thing. Anyway, I had said to him, I said, you know, your friend Crosby just died. He was a great entertainer, great movie star, but you know what? He wasn't nearly you. So he said, hey, kid, and I wasn't a kid, I was in my 40s, he said, hey, kid, don't say anything about Bing. I wanted to be him when I was a kid. I said, no, I said, Francis, I said, the thing is, not only were you a major force in pop music, but you were a political and cultural force, something Sinatra never was. If you hadn't rewritten High Hopes and done that with your guys, Kennedy would have never gotten into the White House. And I said, you know what you should do? And he said, what, kid? I said, you should do an Italian Roots. Well, at the time, there was a show you might remember called Roots, about this black African, Kunta Kinte.
Yes.
It ran 5 consecutive nights on ABC and killed in the ratings. And I said, what you should do, Francis, is let me come to your house in Palm Springs every weekend. I'll put you on camera every weekend for as long as you want. You keep the tapes. I'm going to ask you everything about your life, and you tell your story into camera, and I'll do all the rest. I'll get all the people that knew you, some who loved you, some who hated you. And I'm even going to ask you about Sam Giancana, because the first time I came to Nevada, I was 16 years of age, and I was at the Cal Neva Lodge, and you came arm in arm into the Cal Neva with Sam Giancana. And he just stared at me, and he said, kid, write it up, and how much do you want? And I said, well, I don't want anything. He said, I'll give you, what do you want? I said, well, I took the low end, George. I said, just give me 10%. So I wrote it up, delivered it to his secretary, Dorothy, and I got a call from him the very next day, and he said, we're going to start in a few months, pal. That's what he said. Okay, now, Pete, we couldn't start because I'm doing Real People. I was just too busy to do it, so now I'm out of work. And I get a call from Sinatra. It's time to start. And I'm so excited because here now I'd lost the AM show, but I got bigger. I got Real People. I was making $33,000 a week. Now I'm going to be a millionaire, one of the most famous writer directors.
All right, let's bring it home here. Let's get the – what happened?
What happened was assassination stuff. One of my good friends at the time is a fellow named Robert Blair Kaiser, a former priest who got one of the few interviews with Sirhan Sirhan, wrote one of the definitive books on that assassination called RFK Must Die. He came to my house often. He left the country, left me with his papers and his book, and he says, I'm afraid for my life. Okay, so I read the book. It's compelling. And what do I get with it? I get Thomas Noguchi's autopsy report about Robert Kennedy. And the autopsy report says that the fatal shot could not have been fired from more than 2.5 to 3 inches from the left rear of the ear because of the extensive powder burns to the skull and hair, which means, obviously, that Sirhan couldn't have fired the shot. But Noguchi never said publicly that Sirhan never fired the shot. He said, that's just my autopsy report. The city, for 2 or 3 years, was hounding to get rid of Noguchi. And they couldn't get rid of him. And I got a call from his attorney and asked me if I would come down and speak on Noguchi's behalf because I was also writing Mayor Bradley's material. And so I spoke on Noguchi's behalf. And guess what? Bill Holden dies. Now, how does this have anything to do with Frank Sinatra and the assassination? Bill Holden was a drunk. He fell down in his condominium in Santa Monica and hit his head and bled to death, okay? The LA Times reports it as he passed out and he died. But Noguchi does the autopsy report and said the guy was drunk. That's a blood alcohol content. Cracked his head, was in a stupor, never recovered and bled to death. And that was reported on television to now. The LA Times had to recant the previous story. And Hollywood is now up in arms joining the city council and the LAPD to get rid of Noguchi because he ratted on one of their drunks.
And you had just stood up for him.
And guess who was mounting the charge for Hollywood?
I got you.
Sinatra.
Yeah.
And we never, ever, ever spoke again. Ever again. And so I lost that. And that's when I came. That's when I came out to L.A. Now that time passes, it becomes 1992. And every year since then, 82 to 92, there's another 10 years, I keep transferring the tapes to preserve them. And now there's a big ruckus over Oliver Stone making a movie called JFK. And you, as an adult then, would remember there was a huge, huge furor because one of the researchers doing research for Oliver Stone was jealous of the fact that Stone was dealing more with Jim Mars than with him. And I don't want to mention the guy's name because he's a brilliant researcher who wrote a dozen fabulous new books, books that he printed on his own. But he took the script and he turned it over to Ben Bradley at the Washington Post, who had his CIA apologist critic do a front-page attack on Oliver Stone. And I'm sure Oliver changed some of his movie because of that. But because of the furor, I thought, my God, we can make the documentary now. So I call Oliver's office, and his secretary gets on the phone, and I identify myself, and I said, I've got this 3.5 hours of the real Kevin Costner, Jim Garrison. Would Oliver like to see it? Well, Oliver doesn't want to get on the phone. She says, send it over. I said, no. You send Oliver over here if he wants to look at it. I'm not sending it there. And he never showed up. So I'm stuck with this. I know the story has to be told, but now I have to sell my $900,000 home in Toluca Lake, which is just down from Bob Hope's mansion, and move up to Las Vegas. I don't have the money. And this is where fate stepped in again. This is unbelievable. People used to come by my home because it was so beautiful. It was like a Swiss chalet, just to walk through it. They weren't interested in buying the home. There's a knock at the door. I open the door, and there are two young Mormons there in their middle 20s who were famous trumpet players in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir or someplace like that in Salt Lake City. They're the Brunson brothers, very famous. Anyway, they see that I have these tapes on my TV set, and they say, who's that? I said, that's Jim Garrison. That the thing that Oliver Stone is doing? I said, yeah. He said, well, can we look at it? So we look at some of it, and they say, you should make a documentary.
Really?
And I said,
good idea.
I said, have you got $200,000? And they said, no, but we might be able to help you get it. And I said, how? He said, there's a fellow whose house we just looked at in the Hollywood Hills. His name is Lamar Card. His father's a multimillionaire, and he just set up a production company to selling his home and wants to get into the business. I'll introduce you. He introduces, these two boys introduce me to Lamar, and he helps raise the $200,000 to do the documentary, and that's how it got made.
That's a pretty amazing coincidence there. I want to ask you, we're going to go to a break here in a couple of seconds. When we come back, I'm going to open up the phone lines, get a couple of questions in, but I want to ask you about who gave the order, because you've got some new information about a specific individual who gave the order. I mean, at some point, I think you agree that LBJ had to be involved, the government had to be involved.
You know what? I'm telling you something. There is a book out by Roger Stone, who's going to be one of the speakers, that says
right.
Lyndon Johnson is behind it. Lyndon Johnson, I do not think, and I'm just speculating, I don't think he would ever say to anyone, you got to get rid of him. I mean, a guy like Lansdale, who was a maniac, or Curtis LeMay, who wanted to drop nuclear bombs on Vietnam. He was like a Peter Sellers character out of Dr. Strangelove. Both of these guys were. He had to say, they would say, hey, why can't we do more in Vietnam? And Lyndon would say, well,
no. Hold on, John. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll pick up the conversation about LBJ and see where else this story takes us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We have a final segment remaining with John Barber, whose film, The Garrison Tapes, is the definitive look at the story of Jim Garrison, who tried to get to the bottom of the JFK assassination and paid a heavy price for it, as John Barber did. I have two more questions before we open up the phone lines. One dealing with who gave the order, and the other dealing with the Kennedy family itself, what they may have said behind the scenes, because John in recent times has had direct access to some of the Kennedys and had conversations with them and some insight into what the family believes behind the scenes. So stick with us. We'll get to that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast. John, before we go to the phones, you have a pretty good idea who gave the order. Who was it?
Well, when I interviewed Jim, I asked him, if you were the attorney general now and you could arrest three people, who would you arrest? And he gave me three names. And the very first name he gave me was the name Lawrence V. Myers. Lawrence V. Myers, he concluded through very simple CSI detective work that anybody could have come up with, had tracked down that Lawrence V. Myers was probably the guy that gave the order to Jack Ruby to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. And how he did it is he gathered the phone records of the participants, David Ferry and Clay Shaw and a bunch of other people, and the phone records, and their phone records led to a phone number of Lawrence V. Myers' mistress living at a certain hotel in Chicago. All this documentation is in a new piece that we did in The Last Word on the Assassination, and it's unbelievably compelling. But the point is, at none of these assassination things, not only do you not hear about Evelyn Lincoln's letter, you never hear a word about Lawrence V. Myers, whose son was in military intelligence and in Dallas the day that Kennedy was shot. And all of that is in the documentary. So as far as, you know, there are so many things involved with this. You guys brought up the business of the banks. One of the executive orders that John Kennedy signed was Executive Order 11111, which called for the Treasury to print silver certificates. This would have, and they printed them for 6 months. I have some. This would have put the Federal Reserve, which is just private banks, out of business. The day that he was shot, they stopped printing them, and they'd never printed them. But that executive order has never been rescinded. It's just never been enforced.
Let me ask you this for your insight into the Kennedy family. Because of the production that you were working on, you were trying to do something for the 50th anniversary, and you had interaction with the Kennedys, members of the Kennedy family. Did you get any insight into what they really think, who was responsible? We saw these hints that Jackie O was going to come out with some stuff, or her family was going to release her diaries, or, you know, we've heard different things from Ted Kennedy and hints that Robert F. Kennedy was on the trail of who killed his brother. What do you think?
Well, the truth is, Joan Mellon, who knows more about the Central Intelligence Agency, except for those people at Langley, Virginia, has proof that Robert Kennedy was one of the people interfering with Jim Garrison's investigation for reasons of his own, and he told his kids to stay away from that. Except a year ago, Robert Kennedy was interviewed by Charlie Rose at an opera house in Dallas and said, my father privately did not believe the Warren Report. Now, let me tell you something quickly about the Warren Report. When Garrison tried to bring Shaw to trial, he went through a grand jury to make sure he had enough of the case. Then he took his case to a three-judge panel following that. Well, Shaw's attorney, a guy named Diamond, tried to get the case thrown out and gave the judge proof that the case should be thrown out against his client and handed them the 26 volumes of the Warren Report. And the three judges threw up the Warren Report, calling it hearsay. Hearsay is considered legally just gossip. And Jim Garrison may have lost the conviction for conspiracy to kill, but he got him on perjury. But the federal government stopped in and prevented him from even taking that case to court. There is absolutely no question in 1967, when Jim Garrison stood before the news cameras and said the CIA killed our president, he was absolutely right. And every one of the meaningful researchers in the country know the Central Intelligence Agency killed their president. Now, with the Warren Report, this past year, even Tom Brokaw was doing something apologetic for the Warren Report. Tom is the fellow that brought me to NBC. So I called him and asked him, can I spend 5 minutes on your show talking about Garrison? And he said no. He had no interest in it. So knowing that Bobby had said this to Charlie Rose, I thought, you know, he can't add any information about the CIA, but having a Kennedy president present at UNLV to screen the documentary, and you had graciously agreed to appear for nothing to do the interview with him, a Q&A in front of 1,200 people who are committed to come. The university had already given us free the platform to do this enormous public service. Well, my dealings with him were through Dick Russell, who writes material all the time with him about the environment. And after 3 months of haggling, he agreed to $25,000 fee. It was my last $25,000. I agreed to pay it. He agreed to show up. And as you know, the day before, he canceled. Well, I was so heartbroken because I wasn't looking to sell. It was going to be live event, but I knew millions of people would watch it because a Kennedy was there. So what I did is I took the $25,000, invested in going back to the school who was supportive, and brought in Joan and Dick and Jim. And I must tell you, George, I am so happy that Bobby Kennedy ran off and hid in the woods. Now, he did it for his own reasons, but his speaker's agent said that if you speak about Kennedy's, I can no longer book you for $25,000 to speak about the environment. And I sent a note to him saying, listen, you cannot clean up the natural polluted environment in this country until you clean up the polluted political environment, which starts with the murder of your father and your uncle. And I never got a response from him. And I'm glad I never got a response, because I must tell you, 50 years from now, when they hold more meetings about this, they'll only look at two films. There's the Zapruder film and The Last Word on the Assassination, because Joan and Dick and Jim did something absolutely wonderfully historical with much of the new information that you've referenced during this interview.
Let's take a couple of calls. First time caller, Charles in Fort Worth. Hi, Charles. You're on with John Barber.
Hello? I can no longer book you for $25,000.
Charles, I'm sorry. We can't hear you. We've got some kind of a delay working there. Very sorry about that. We're going to go to west of the Rockies, Tom in Riverside. Hi, Tom. You're on with John Barber.
Hi. I wanted to ask John, it's a good show, or excellent show, but I wanted to ask John, the George H. Bush, he was in the CIA during that time. He seems to be such a central figure in this, and I never hear a lot about him being involved in that, but he seems to me, after coining the New World Order and those Gulf Wars, and his dad's connection, I think, with the Dulles brothers, wasn't it, and the rest of it, he seems to be right in the middle of this.
Yeah, that's a really good question. George Bush was president in Dallas when it happened. And in The Last Word in the Assassination, Jim Mars, bless his heart, has all that information about how George Bush was debriefed by J. Edgar Hoover. And there's a memo that J. Edgar Hoover wrote, and he's outing George Bush as an asset for the CIA. He says, I've just interviewed George Bush of the CIA, and all that is introduced in The Last Word in the Assassination. There is a site that is devoted to the fact that George Bush was behind it. And I read a lot of that material, and I can't conclude anything. I think maybe the Bushes and the Kennedys were the Hatfields and the McCoys of the last 50 years in this country, but I can't prove any of that, so I just read it for information. But George Bush not only was in the CIA, but the head of the CIA became the president of the United States. How much control does the Central Intelligence Agency have over the American government? They have total control, beginning with George Bush.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. East of the Rockies, Pat in Minneapolis. You're on with John Barber.
John, you mentioned Kitty Kelly's book, and I agree with you that many people knew ahead of time about the assassination, but I think the prime mover who plotted and planned it and told the others was hinted at by her book, whether she realized it or not. There was a great protection around President Kennedy, having nothing to do with the Secret Service or any part of the government, and that was his friendship with Frank Sinatra. Kitty Kelly wrote an unauthorized biography of Sinatra, and she mentioned that when Kennedy was going to go to the West Coast trip, he was going to stay at Sinatra's place, where Sinatra had knocked out tennis courts and a swimming pool to make a landing strip.
I know where you're going. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And the person who told him, you can't go to Sinatra's, you have to go to Bing Crosby's instead because it'll look too mob, because your dad was involved with the mob during the bootleg days, blah, blah, blah. Who was that person that destroyed the friendship of Kennedy and Sinatra, who would never speak to him again?
Peter Lawford was assigned that job, and Sinatra would never speak to him afterwards. And one of the prime reasons that John Kennedy moved it to Crosby's house was because Sinatra and John Kennedy had also had a liaison, as did Sam Giancana, with Judith Campbell.
Well, the person who told him was J. Edgar Hoover. And I believe that was the true plotter and planner of the he informed other people knew ahead of time because J. Edgar Hoover needed them to know how to play their parts. I don't think that I think Johnson knew ahead of time, but I don't think it was his idea. But there were many people who knew ahead of time.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Thanks, Pat. Thank you.
J. Edgar Hoover planning it. I don't think he planned that one, but I think he did plan the hit on Martin Luther King.
You do?
Yes, I do. And there's a wonderful book out by Dick Gregory and Mark Lane. It was originally called Codename Zorro, which was the code name the FBI had for Martin Luther King. And then now you can see throughout the Internet this letter that Hoover sent to King suggesting that he commit suicide. And when I first tried to review the book in the mid-70s, and this is all material taken from the House Select Committee, I was kicked out of NBC's newsroom because they wouldn't let me do the review.
Try to get one more call in. Jeff in Culver City on the Wild Card line. Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Yeah, hi, George and Mr. Barber. Yes, I once read this book entitled No Greater Friend by Michael Gorelick. This book was basically talking about Kennedy's relationship with Israel and the Palestinian land situation. The author wrote that during these early years of Israel's existence, Kennedy pondered over reconciliation with the Palestinians, but the Israeli intelligence agencies made sure that there would never be any reconciliation. My question is this, Mr. Barber. Since Jack Rubenstein, also known as Jack Ruby, successfully silenced Lee Harvey Oswald by killing him, do you think that Jack Rubenstein was a Shin Bet or a Mossad operative?
No,
and what about Mr. Magruder and his perfect timing of filming the assassination? And I'll take your answer off the air.
You bring up something really interesting. First of all, John Kennedy tried for a year and a half to get AIPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, registered as a foreign lobby, which they fought heart and soul. After Kennedy was killed, Lyndon Johnson let it be. They have never registered as a foreign lobby, and they should, because they lobby for Israel. Also, John Kennedy wanted inspections of their nuclear plants in Israel open, and the Israelis did not want that. As far as there's a lot of talk about maybe the Mossad was involved with it, who knows on a lower level, but on a higher level, only the President of the United States can shut down an investigation into a murder of a fellow president. Israel couldn't do that. The mob couldn't do that. Only the Central Intelligence Agency and the President of the United States.
So you think LBJ was directly involved?
I don't know. I think it would just
at some level
be speculation, but there's unquestionably no doubt that he probably had inklings that it was going to happen. I mean, Lansdale was a Kennedy hater, and Joan Mellon now has documentation and proof that Lansdale was identified as one of the people in Dealey Plaza. So there were a lot of people who knew it. And I don't think we have time to tell this story, but I'll tell it as quick as I can. One of the photographers that we had who traveled with us in the country, his name was George Elkins. He, like I, had a very estranged relationship with his father. After the documentary came out and the father saw it, the father called George, the son, and said, "Son, you did a wonderful job. I'd like to speak to John." "About what?" He said, "Well, come on over to the house." I had seen his father in years. He couldn't believe it. Anyway, his father was now retired. He was the second in charge of intelligence in Vietnam. And he said, "I have a lot of things that I would like to talk to John about." So they set up a breakfast meeting at a place called Patty's in Toluca Lake. And I went there and met him for breakfast 2 days later. And he sat and he just said, looked at me for the longest time. And he said, "You know, you've done a wonderful piece of work. And I have a lot of things that I want to talk to you about, but I can't." Well, George, the son, do you know that the Central Intelligence Agency gives Academy Awards and they give Emmys? Did you know that, George?
I had no idea.
Yeah, they have annual gatherings every year to give these awards. And what they do is they videotape them and they give the participants the awards and then they take them back.
And I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, and they file the tapes. Well, George got a call one day to come back to Langley to do one of these things. And George thought it was a joke. And he said, "Well, you can't afford me," talking to the CIA. And they said, "How much does it cost?" And George said off of the top of his head, $50,000. Within an hour, $50,000 was in his bank. And he went back twice to do it. He didn't know how it happened, but his father had set it up. Anyway, sitting across from the coffee table, I'll tell you two stories.
No, you can't. We got a minute left.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, John. We'll have to have you come back and do that. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
All the people who hope there's a new tribunal, a new investigation, congressional hearings, it just strikes me as the guys who keep this story under wraps and confused and muddy the waters are better at their job than the public is in ferreting out the truth. So are you hopeful?
George, it will never happen. There is no leadership. And again, the only way it could happen is if there is a groundswell, and that groundswell can only come from these assassination groups that gather willy-nilly every November 22nd. There should be just one function to invade November, turn it into our Bastille Day every November 22nd. Something is bound to happen. There is no leadership on the public's part, even though we know the truth and we outnow them, because as Mark Twain said 100 years ago, if voting mattered, they wouldn't let us do it.
John Barber, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you, George.
All right. Thanks to John Barber, my earlier guest, Jim Mars. Thanks also my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staten, Gina Salvati, Dan Galati, Webmaster Lex, and Chris Burrows. I'll be back next Sunday, everyone, with my guest, Bob Lazar. Hope you can tune in then.